Did you know that as of tomorrow, I will have been your pastor for 6 months? It's also true that before I stand in the pulpit again, I will have completed 21 years of ordained ministry. And I can say without hesitation that the time I've spent at Montclair has been by far the best 1/42nd of my career. So thank you. Thank you. One of the things that I like best about this congregation is your worship, or as you would say, your celebration. I like that you have a pipe organ and the occasional African drum. I like that you're unafraid to clap. I like that you're willing to understand the spiritual benefits of show tunes. I like how you welcome children, not just into the sanctuary, but into the leadership of celebration, letting them serve communion and march in with streamers. I love your willingness to try new things. I love how you sing. Honestly, the only thing I miss about the way my former congregations worshiped, the only element that I would change in this congregation's celebration is this. I would say the Lord's Prayer from time to time. Now, can I get an amen? Now, I know that the Lord's Prayer can feel kind of stodgy and old school. And I understand that saying Our Father is problematic in a community that understands and appreciates all the ways that God is our mother in heaven. I also know that saying Thy Kingdom Come is hard for those uncomfortable with a regal and hierarchical deity. Certainly the Lord's Prayer has its issues. But I believe I am a better person because pretty much every Sunday for more than 40 years I have said the words, Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Incidentally, Presbyterians are, as far as I know, the only English-speaking Christians who say, Forgive us our debts. Most everyone else says, Forgive us our trespasses. And from time to time, people ask me why this is, and I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody knows the answer. But it has been suggested that Presbyterians say debts and not trespasses because our denomination got its start in Scotland. Take it from the man who stands before you in a kilt. A Scotsman would rather be forgiven a debt than a trespass any day of the week, and twice on Sundays. Actually, the Lord's Prayer is recorded twice in the Gospels, once in Luke and once in Matthew. Luke's version says trespasses and Matthew's says debts. And this makes sense given the tradition that tells us the book of Matthew was written by the Apostle Matthew, who was a tax collector. No doubt he understood the concept of indebtedness more than any of the other disciples. Matthew knew what it was to be owed money. And he probably knew what it meant to owe people money as well. As a tax collector, he collected money from those in his debt, and he passed that money up the food chain that eventually led to Rome, which meant he probably owed quotas of collected taxes to his supervisors all the time. It's no surprise, then, that Matthew, when he talks of forgiveness, uses debt as a metaphor, not just in the Lord's Prayer, but in this morning's lesson from later in the book as well. And I like using Matthew's economic metaphor to talk about forgiveness because I think it really helps to clarify the meaning of forgiveness, which I happen to think is one of the most misunderstood words in the English language. Far too many people think that forgiving is the same as forgetting. Forgive and forget, we say, as if the words are synonymous because they both begin with a letter F. Dearly beloved, lots of words begin with a letter F. They don't all mean the same thing. Hear me now when I say that amnesia is no virtue. And it has nothing to do with the grace that accompanies forgiveness. Rather, forgiveness is canceling a debt. And here's what I mean. If I harm you in some way, then I am indebted to you. I owe you satisfaction and probably some kind of reparation for the injury that I have caused. And so long as I am in your debt, the harm that I have caused to you connects us in the same way we would be connected if you were a bank and you held the mortgage on my house. Now, if I harm you and the harm and you forgive me, if I harm you and you forgive me, then the harm I have caused no longer connects us, just as we no longer would be connected if you were a bank and I paid off my mortgage. To forgive someone who has harmed you is not to forget what they have done. In fact, in some cases, the person who forgets is liable to be harmed again, which recreates the debt and makes forgiveness necessary once more, perhaps with compounded interest. Nor is forgiveness necessarily about restoring a relationship. Forgiveness can be about restoring a relationship if something besides injury binds you to the person who has harmed you. So if your sister hurts you and you forgive her, the harm gets out of the way of your relationship with her, and that's great. But if you forgive the spouse who has abused you, the bully who has harassed you, or even the stranger who, while driving drunk, crashed into a car your loved one was driving, causing a fatality and, by extension, doing irreparable damage to the most tender places of your soul. If you forgive those people, you are not restoring a relationship. Rather, you are saying that you will not be emotionally or spiritually connected to your abuser, to the bully, or to the drunk driver who has ruined your life. And I think that is an exceptionally healthy thing to do. Forgiveness is a means of grace, and it's a source of peace, not just for the person who is forgiven, but also, and I think more so, for the person who forgives. Forgiveness pulls us out of the cycle of injury and retribution, and that is good for everyone. In fact, I would say it's dangerous not to forgive. And as a way of illustrating this point, I'd like to draw your attention to two events that happened last week. On Wednesday evening, President Obama laid out plans for the escalation of the bombing campaign against a group of terrorists that calls itself the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. On the next day, we observed the 13th anniversary of 9/11, and the two are inherently connected. I won't say that the United States is entirely responsible for the evil and vile entity that is the Islamic State, because I believe that each individual, including members of the ISIS military apparatus, are responsible for their own actions. But I also know that if the United States had responded differently to 9/11, there would be no ISIS. On September 11, 2001, terrorists killed nearly 3,000 people in New York and in Washington, D.C. and in Pennsylvania, and it was tragic, and we the people decided that someone had to pay the debt incurred by those terrorists. We went after the Taliban in Afghanistan, and then we attacked and conquered Iraq, even though that nation had no role in 9/11. 13 years later, we're at war with an enemy more religiously obnoxious than the Taliban and more violent and repressive than Saddam Hussein. And who knows? Maybe we should try to stop ISIS with the force of arms, but let us not be deceived. There is no such thing as a war to end all wars. It turns out that war leads to more war. It doesn't matter how many times you write mission accomplished on an aircraft carrier. At some point, we as a nation, together with all the nations and factions in the Middle East, are going to have to try something besides war. We're going to have to give peace a chance. And I say this as a peacenik, but I also say it as a pragmatist. We simply can't go on killing one another. Either we'll run out of money or we'll run out of people to kill, or the crucible of violence will render an enemy so horrible it will conquer us. And then we're all doomed. Again, I speak as a peacenik, but I also speak as a pragmatist. when I say it would have been much better for everyone, ourselves included, if we as a nation had chosen not to collect the debt incurred by Al-Qaeda on 9/11. I don't mean we should have excused their actions. And I think we were right to beef up security and law enforcement efforts as a way of stopping attacks of terror before they happen. But I cannot help but wonder how different, how much better the world would be today if instead of demanding satisfaction for those killed on 9/11, our nation had decided that the lives of those lost on that morning were so precious to us, so filled with intrinsic worth, so beautiful, so valuable that no amount of bloodshed or warfare could pay the debt incurred by those who took them from us. Instead, we tried to collect the debt. In Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen, and in the global war on terror, directly and indirectly, we have killed more than 600,000 people, most of them civilians, and we're still at war. And the debt remains outstanding. At some point, we're going to have to try forgiveness. I believe something similar, though admittedly much smaller, happens when we don't forgive those who have harmed us. It's not easy, especially when the injury is deep and profound. But if we insist on collecting the debt incurred by harm, if we remain connected to those who injure us, we never will know peace. We will forever be restless. If we insist on seeking retribution, things can get nasty. It's far better to break free from the cycle of harm and recompense, the cycle of debt and impossible repayment. I think this is why the punishment for the ungrateful servant in this morning's lesson is so severe. When we refuse to forgive others as we have been forgiven, it is indeed a recipe for weeping and gnashing of teeth. Only it isn't the divine master who inflicts this punishment. It is we ourselves. Therefore, truly I say, we should forgive those who harm us. Not 7 times, but 70 times, or 7 times 70 times, or as many times as it takes to bring us peace.